Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. Firstly, a thank you to all of you for coming at such an early start to this conference. I've been travelling a lot over the last couple of weeks. I was in the UK and China and Hong Kong for a couple of weeks. I've been back in Australia and had to go to Canberra, and was last night in Tasmania before flying back. So, like many of you, the tolls of life and travel have been sort of quite great. And this morning I was making myself a cup of coffee, and I was about to put some instant coffee into the cup, and went to grab a teaspoon to do that. And for the first time in my life, and with no sort of mental component of it, I reached for a tablespoon. And I thought, that's interesting. What is my body trying to tell me about where I'm up to, and sort of, my need for perhaps a bit more sleep in my life? So I appreciate all of you coming. The topic that I'm going to touch on for today, what's next, is, in one sense, a very challenging topic. There are so many interesting innovations that are going on in e-learning today, and I can't even begin to cover all of them. I can't cover even, say, a quarter of them. And, of course, one of the great things about innovations and making predictions about the future is that, most of the time we get it wrong. It's always very hard to know exactly what will become really important and what won't in the future. I was reminded only yesterday of a famous quote by the head of the US Patent Office from just before 1900, where he said that everything had been invented. And so all the patents of the last 100 years or so were things that he didn't expect were going to be ahead of him. And so I will do my best to talk about a few what I think are interesting technologies that are coming up in this area, but really there are so many more out there and so many more yet to come. It's an area that we will continue to watch. I'm going to touch just a little bit on e-learning sort of innovation in general. I'm going to briefly refer to five technologies or sort of new approaches that I think are interesting, sort of Web 2.0 approaches. I'll talk a bit about blogs and wikis. I'll talk about podcasting. I'll talk about open source software as a general concept, but how it's starting to affect learning and training. And then I'll talk about learning design, which is one of the particular areas that I work in a lot within this field. And as part of that, I'll give you just a little bit of a case study of an example of some learning design software that we've been working on, something called LAMS, which introduces some new ideas about thinking about particularly group-based learning and about blended learning contexts where you're combining both technology and face-to-face. And the final thing I'd like to touch on this morning, just at the end, is a little bit of a reflection on the way that new technologies, new innovations affect organisations. And sometimes the changes are incremental. They are small things that add to what we already do. They improve something, they make something more efficient or the quality a little bit better. But in doing that, they don't have any larger impact on the way we do business. And that is as compared to other technologies where, as useful and as interesting as they are, they also tend to have certain disruptive effects on the way that perhaps we run training or the way that our trainees or learners receive training. And so they have this mixed element of being both innovative and interesting and yet disruptive in the way they affect our practice. And so I'll end by reflecting a little bit on that component. So I think for many of us, e-learning or technologies for learning has been around really for quite some time now. The sort of web-based e-learning systems have been going for somewhat, around about a decade now, and certainly there was computer-based training before that. And one of the questions I think always to consider, particularly for large organisations, is the balance between innovation and more traditional implementation. That is, there's a body of knowledge about what we do with e-learning. For example, the use of learning management systems as a core component, the ways you can use that with courseware, and also to track people's training and performance. This is now a fairly standard, well-understood, kind of traditional thing in, 2007. And so as you look at any given organisation, one of the questions you can ask is that organisation getting the well-known and understood benefits of that kind of core e-learning technology? Because if it's not, there's quite a lot that can be done to help that, and there's a lot of good practice that you can look to give you ideas or examples about how to go about doing it. On the other hand, there are many innovations coming along all the time, and now is a particularly rich period of innovation for technology in education. And so that is another thing to look to see how that can help organisations and can help with training. And so the first thing I'd say is, I'm going to focus almost entirely on some of the new and interesting things for today. It's always important to start with a kind of reflection on the balance between, implementation of what we already know and what works well, and on the other hand, trying out new things to see what happens. The new things will often be exciting, and so it's only natural to be drawn towards those, but I think one always needs to try and reflect on the balance between getting the fundamentals right while at the same time thinking about new things. And it's worth also bearing in mind that while for this talk I'm going to focus particularly on innovation in the technology sphere, it's not the only area in which we can innovate. You know, we can also innovate in our strategy, the way that we bring training to our organisations, the way that technology can help us, the way that we might liaise with our chief executive officer and other senior management to explain the value of training, the directions that it can contribute to an organisation. There's all sorts of innovations in that field which may not require any technology at all, or of which technology is just one modest component. And yet one can think about innovative strategies for using that approach in training, quite independent of the technologies themselves. And also, we've seen some great examples of innovative content, different types of courseware, innovative use of interactive exercises, of simulations, of perhaps video and case studies. And that's another dimension of innovation that can be of great value and, again, can bring richness to the training that you might provide or manage in the context in which you work. And that is, while that has a technology component to it, it's also a part over and above the basic learning platform that we might have within our organisations. So again, as a kind of framing comment, I think it's worth just to bear in mind that innovation in technology is only one of a range of innovative approaches that might be relevant depending on where you work, your organisation, the kind of people that you work with. And I think one of the things to be conscious of within this sort of, where we are today in the sense of, we have certain well understood technologies like learning management systems. Many of the most innovative things are now happening outside the learning management system. The way that people are doing interesting things with, say, blogs or wikis or podcasts or, other types of software is often happening now at the periphery or at least outside the direct remit of the learning management system. And so being aware of that and how they are going to relate to each other. Does it matter if you are, running some blogs as part of the way you're doing training? If they have no connection back to your learning management system, is that an issue for you? Is that going to create any difficulties with perhaps tracking of content or knowing what's been said within the organisation? Or are you happy for the blogs to be an innovative new thing that have their own life, perhaps for a certain period, a year or so, and then at the end of that you might reflect on how might I connect that back to my more general platform? And when you're playing with some of the innovative technologies, I think it's also important to be cautious or at least conscious of some of the risks that come with it. I'm not going to talk about risks a great deal today, but I think they are worth flagging. One of the ones that's come up quite often lately is staff members who have blogs where they talk about, their ideas, their experiences, perhaps what they're doing within an organisation. If those blogs are publicly available, if anyone can read them, and then if that staff member is posting to them things that might not be appropriate to be read in the public domain, that can cause some quite significant problems. And we've seen cases where employees have lost their job because they posted something inappropriate to a blog. Maybe they revealed something that was internal information that wasn't meant to be public, and then they commented on it in the public sphere. Maybe they said something inappropriate, or they were critical of their senior management in a way that was not appreciated. These are one of the things to keep in mind in this sort of new area. And a number of companies now, where they encourage blogging, the posting of these kind of personal reflections, have developed policies to say, look, these are the sort of things we think are appropriate for the way our staff use blogs. These are the things that would not be appropriate for a blog where the person is doing that in terms of their company approach. Another one is that the rise of open source software has become one of the quite powerful drivers for a range of these innovations, and because there is generally no cost, or at least very low cost, to adopting open source software, it's become quite widely taken on. But any of you who've talked to a central IT department, which is not a frequent user of open source software, will know that that can sometimes be a challenging or a bracing conversation where you try to explain some innovative thing that you like that you want to try, and central IT says, well, no, we don't support that, or we're not comfortable with that, or we would want to evaluate that in much more detail than you have. And so as another example of an interesting and innovative area with many great things are going on, keeping in mind your wider organisation's culture, and for example, if you have an IT department where open source for them is challenging or unfamiliar or not part of a corporate strategy, then you need to sort of be quite careful in how you think through whether you would use that kind of approach, and if so, how you would explain it to your IT colleagues. So that's, I suppose, a little bit of a backdrop to some of the interesting innovations that are going on. And I think one of the things that's useful as a kind of lens through which to look at different innovations is the distinction between formal learning and informal learning within our organisations. You know, formal learning as in the training courses that we might run or organise or lead ourselves, or otherwise formal, you know, types of learning programs instituted by the organisation with some sense of structure and direction, very often group-based learning, as opposed to more informal types of learning, which is the sort of knowledge management and the general professional development of our staff in their areas of expertise, whatever it is that the staff you work with, you know, whether it's banking and finance or, you know, other government areas or whatever it might be. Many people are sort of trying to update their skills and their understanding by, you know, reading the latest articles that have come out or reading case studies, trying to learn from colleagues and friends about good ideas that have worked in other places. And so informal learning is a very important part of the wider context of training that goes on in our organisations. And I think if we use these two ideas as a way of looking at innovations, it can help us to understand where a particular innovation might be quite useful or where it may not be quite as suitable. So, for example, and I'll talk more on these in a moment, but the use of blogs and also wikis in many of the contexts I have seen has been quite good as an informal learning tool. You know, whereas a way of getting ideas out, of fostering some communication, in the case of wikis, of getting some shared editing and creation of content or documents, it can be a great way of just letting individuals get to know each other, to share ideas, to mentor, to provide experience, but outside of any particularly formal context of sort of directed training. Whereas on the other hand, some innovations, and the area of learning design that I'll talk about towards the end of today, is one that's particularly good for formal learning. Learning design is where a trainer or another type of instructor structures a series of tasks as a kind of workflow of activities. You know, I have a group of people and first I want them to reflect on this idea and post some messages. I want them to discuss that. I want them to review these documents. Perhaps then I want to have a face-to-face training session with them and do some activities. Maybe after that, then I want them to, you know, have some further reflection, maybe some new ideas to comment on those. And so the idea in learning design is the structuring of a kind of flow of tasks, and very often a mixture of both online tasks and face-to-face tasks. Well, learning design as innovative area is great for formal learning because it works best when you have a group of learners and some sense of direction as to the purpose of what they're doing, often some role of an instructor who's designed the activities that they want those people to go through. But for informal learning, it can be more challenging because it generally is used for group-based learning. And so if you can have a structure of group-based tasks, it's hard to coordinate a kind of amorphous set of individuals sort of at all different times and all different stages in their learning to bring them together to actually run them through that unless there is some kind of formal training push. And it's worth saying there'll be a number of technologies that can work well in either of these contexts depending on how they're used. Podcasts, where you record audio of, you know, lectures or other kinds of talks, can be great for informal learning if you build up a library of talks by, you know, experts within your organisation or elsewhere that people can just browse and listen to as, you know, when they feel that they could learn something useful from it. On the other hand, you may want to use podcasts directly as part of a formal training program. You know, recording of lectures that have been given, making sure that if people can't come to a face-to-face session, they can listen to the podcast afterwards to follow up on that formal training. And so in for that particular technology, it can work well in either formal or informal context. Just depends a bit on what would suit what you're doing and what you're trying to achieve. So let me now move to just a very brief overview, and I appreciate for many of you some of these are already quite familiar and you may already be using them in your practice, so I just want to run across the top of them and reflect on them a little bit. Web 2.0 has been one of the, you know, the biggest hyped terms of about the last year or so within the IT world, and it has had a significant impact in many ways. It's hard to describe quite what it is. It's about new ways of thinking about using technology, and particularly the internet. It's about what's often called user-generated content. That is where instead of just assuming that we are passive consumers of what we find on the internet or, you know, find on intranets, rather that we are co-creators. Everyone has the ability to create materials in their own right, to share those. You know, in the general internet, it might be that I can share my photos or it might be that I can share videos and so on. In a corporate or context or an intranet context, it might be about empowering all workers to contribute to an intranet, to post their own ideas, to share perspectives, not merely just those with the ability to edit, you know, the files that would go onto the intranet. And Web 2 approaches have proved to be particularly useful for kind of knowledge management style contexts where you have large and often amorphous sets of knowledge, you know, of a wide range of kinds, and different people have different expertise in those areas, but you're trying to bring them together in some wider way. And so by empowering, you know, all the different people who might have expertise within an organisation to contribute that in, and then allowing the wider set of people to be able to focus on what they found useful, perhaps to rate things, to comment on it, to co-edit and develop materials. This has been one of the tools that is particularly good at sort of fostering bottom-up and collaborative sharing of knowledge in a way that's often very hard to mandate from a kind of top-down perspective. When it comes to specifically e-learning areas, some of the things that organisations are doing that they're finding useful is bringing in RSS feeds. These are news items that are being brought in, and putting together a set of useful news items you want to provide through your intranet or, you know, through different subgroups, perhaps even within large organisations, as a way of keeping people up to date on the latest news without expecting them to go out and browse all possible news. You know, in a sense, the training department can act as a funnel to pick out key news items or articles and so on that might be of value to people to read. We've also seen the use of group tagging. This is where you allow people to tag, you know, articles of interest or other things to be able to say, this is of interest to me and here's a description, a word or a phrase that describes it for me. And then allowing other people to see the different tags people have used for different articles. And in some cases, where certain tags become particularly popular to describe certain material, they then become a basis for actually going and searching and looking at materials based on the tags. So it's sort of a way of allowing groups to describe material that they share with each other and then provide that as a social mechanism for sharing of descriptive terms, you know, searching and so on. Blogs and wikis are often seen as a subcomponent of Web 2.0, although I'll talk about them in their own right in a moment. But the use of internal blogs as a way of doing discussion of strategy or new ideas or innovation, projects where they evolve over time and where it's often not clear where it is you're going to get to in the end. You know, you're trying out new ideas, you're trying out a new product, maybe you're developing a new product. These are areas where the sort of the conversational approach of posting messages, you know, every day or every couple of days and so on, to a team-based blog can be a great way of getting ideas and innovation flowing, particularly if people don't see each other face-to-face. You know, team-based blogs have, in many contexts, replaced these sort of water cooler discussions that happen when everyone's physically together. But if you've got an organisation with many offices and with key people distributed over different locations, blogs can be a great way of sort of providing an alternative for that sort of ongoing discussion. And equally, wikis, where groups can do team-based editing, can be, in a similar way, a great mechanism for getting expertise and sharing of ideas and also editing and polishing of ideas by a group where not everyone can be together or where, say, emailing a document around can prove to be, you know, more difficult or more tiresome as a way of editing. Wikis can be a great alternative to that. So to give you an idea, one of the phrases now often used in this area is mashups. Mashups in Web 2.0 are examples where you bring together different sets of content or information from different places into a single unified thing to achieve some new interesting aggregate. And I was just having a look at this one only last night. It's an example where someone has taken the Google Maps maps for New York. You can see them on the right-hand side. They've gone and taken a whole bunch of their own photos of different locations and they've connected the photos onto the map. But what they've also then done is they've used Wikipedia as a sort of encyclopedia-based knowledge of parts of New York and linked that to different locations. And the outcome of this is the ability to do kind of walking tours of New York, where you're pulling together, you know, a map-based view, photographs of what you're looking at, and, you know, content from an encyclopedia about the locations you're looking at, all within a single view. And so what's fantastic here is that each of these bits on their own were of some value, but by combining them together and making them an interactive sort of walking trail, which is what has been done here, we get more value overall than any of the individual parts. And so, as just one small example of a mashup that happens in Web 2.0, increasingly we're seeing the approach where you start to bring content from different places that, when connected together, has a greater value than it might do when it's on its own. So that's just a really a very brief touch on some of the Web 2 ideas. I want to talk briefly a bit more about blogs and wikis because they become one of the real powerhouse tools in this area. A blog or a web log or a web diary, for those of you not so familiar with it, and a wiki, which is a set of web pages where it's very easy for anyone to edit them, or anyone perhaps within an organisation, if you're doing an internal wiki. These two technologies have become very common, and in sort of corporate training and communications, because very often these tools are at the interface between communication strategies and training strategies. Blogs have been very popular as a way of kind of recording personal thoughts and informal reflections. And that might be useful as something as a public strategy where you put blogs that are available to anyone on the internet and anyone can read them as a way of showing how your organisation is thinking, how it's developing, getting messages out to your clients or to your customers about where your organisation is headed if it's a public blog. Or also it can be great as an internal blog, and I've seen some very useful ones. As I said, we've got evolving areas, perhaps new product developments or a new program where you're still feeling your way as you go as to what something is or how something is rolling out, and you keep a quite honest and candid set of reflections about that on a blog as a way that people can understand how maybe a new program of training or a new product and so on is evolving over time. Wikis in a sort of a training or a learning context we've seen as being a very powerful way of building knowledge bases quickly and effectively because you empower the experts within your organisation to edit, to contribute, to edit each other's posts where there's something that's incorrect or needs expansion or changing, and over time you get very quickly from sort of a rough and ready set of notes up to some quite polished websites as people sort of co-develop and co-create those materials. And it's the ease with which that can be done that's at the heart of the success of wikis. Now, for many years we've had web page editing tools, you know, Microsoft Front Page and Dreamweaver and so on, and they have their place, but the thing that wikis do is make it just so easy for anyone to be able to just quickly click on a page, add to it or change a bit of it and update it. And for those of you not familiar with it, wikis also always keep a log of the previous versions and any changes, so you can revert back to them if for some reason you make a mistake or if the edit that someone makes is not appropriate. But this ability to very quickly add to develop is a great way of building knowledge bases and of exposing sort of corporate knowledge, corporate memory that might exist among your experts up into a more solid form than just, you know, the discussions that might happen around a water cooler. So these are two of the very useful technologies that we see at the moment. An interesting example, this is Jonathan Schwartz's blog. Jonathan Schwartz is the CEO of Sun Microsystems, one of the major technology companies. And for quite some time now, he's been regularly posting honest, candid reflections about how Sun is going as an organisation, what it's trying to achieve, you know, its goals for the future, his interactions with clients and customers, and doing that as a public blog to help people know about Sun's strategy. And I've been a reader of this one for quite a time, and I think it's a fantastic example of how a blog can be used as both a communication strategy out to external parties, but also to internal staff. It actually provides a way that staff within Sun can keep up to date on the latest thinking of their CEO and senior management and where the company is headed. And as it turns out, I was just looking at this one last night, and Sun have just announced that they are now going to start releasing their quarterly earnings reports and their sort of stock market information via this format as their primary way of getting information across. And in fact, they're going to put out all their stock market information 10 minutes before they release it to all the financial analysts on Wall Street via this mechanism. And so that is, in fact, a quite transformational use of this technology to say, we want the public, we want anyone to know about how we're going as a company. You don't have to go to the financial analysts who have some special channel to that information to get that. We're going to use this public blog as a way of telling everyone how Sun is doing as a company. So I think it's a fascinating example, and if any of you are interested in how CEOs can use blogs as a communication mechanism, I'd strongly recommend this as a great example. In terms of wikis, within my own research centre at Macquarie University, we do quite a lot of software development on this system called LAMS, which I'll mention in a moment. And we've been using a wiki as a way of documenting how the programmers are developing the software, what decisions they're making, and allowing each programmer on the team to be able to add different components has become a really effective way of getting the knowledge out of the heads of our programmers and into a public forum so that anyone can understand how the software works, where it's headed, they can see ideas about it, and where possible, people who are outside our organisation contributing to develop, they can also add to the wiki and to add comments and ideas. And so we found this has been a great sort of knowledge base for working in our context with software developers of getting much of the understanding that in the old days would have been in people's heads and would have been in the discussion had at meetings, but you would never record that discussion. Now we have a capture of that that anyone can read and go back to and refer. And when we have new staff come into the project, one of the first things they can do is start reading this wiki to learn all about the way the software works and its internals. And they can see who's posted comments and who's edited. So if they read something and they can't understand it, they can then even go and find the expert within the software development team to learn more about that. So I've been fascinated to watch this just in the last year or two in my own context. Wikis have become almost now just, par for the course. We use them all the time because they're such great tools for dealing with distributed teams where there's a need to get experts to share knowledge in a kind of grassroots and collaborative way. Podcasts is another one that's becoming very popular. A podcast is really just a digital audio recording of a lecture or of some kind of other talk. You don't have to have an iPod to have a podcast. That's just been one of the very popular mechanisms. And if you haven't heard the phrase vodcast, then you will hear it soon. It's a video version of a podcast, so you actually record video and audio. And it can be a great way to provide a record for those who miss a formal session, or a way of providing for those who might never be able to come to a face-to-face formal lecture, a way for them to catch up on great material. People with busy lives and with organisations distributed over many locations, if you have an expert come in to give a talk or otherwise provide some material, it's often really sad that only the people who are in the room for that 1 hour or whatever it might be are the ones who get the benefit of that. Once they walk out, that's it. So using podcasts, which is a very simple technology to just make sure you have an audio recording of talks, can be a great way to see that many more people will benefit than those who can actually be there. Some other benefits of podcasts are that for our trainees or our learners, it means that they can listen to it when they choose. They can also stop it, and so if they're maybe halfway through a podcast and they have to take a call, they can stop it, take the call, come back and listen to the rest of it. And perhaps best of all, the ability to replay the audio recording. So if there are difficult concepts in what is being explained and you don't understand them at sort of first blush, you can go back and replay a section of a podcast, or in fact the entire podcast, to get a better understanding of what's going on. In my own context at Macquarie University a couple of years ago made a decision that it would start audio recording every lecture given in every course. And if you go now to Macquarie, practically every lecture is automatically recorded now as a podcast and made available to students within that course. And this has been a major innovation because it allows our students to have much more flexibility in the way that they study, and it also allows them to go back and replay difficult concepts, difficult ideas. And one of the great things about the way Macquarie did it was they built the infrastructure for creating the podcasts basically into the podiums. So as a lecturer, I don't have to do anything for the podcast to happen. I walk into my lecture, I give my presentation, and about 40 minutes later, bang, the audio file goes up on the learning management system. Now, that's taken a certain amount of investment and back-end technology to make it possible, but it's had a very significant impact on, the flexibility for students who study at Macquarie University. This is a course that I teach. It's a master's course in education, and you can see this little link here, iLecture. That's just the name of the technology we use, and so students from here can click on that and then they will get to see a listing of all the lectures that I've given within the semester. They can click on any of those, they can listen to them as streaming audio, or they can download them as audio files and put them on their iPod or their laptop or whatever else and listen to them when they choose, replay them and so on. And from my perspective as a lecturer, one of the great things on this is it doesn't take me any extra work to make that happen. Well, if you don't have all the fancy back-end technology that Macquarie's invested in, there are great simple ways of doing podcasts. It is now very easy to get little microphones that can plug into Apple's iPods to make it very simple to record a session. And as it happens, I'm doing that right now for this session, and all it took me was to get the microphone, and then I pressed one button, and it just starts audio recording. At the end, I press one button, and it saves it. and I've got it as an audio file. I can then stick that up on the web or on an intranet and so on. And so the potential for sort of your own podcasts, even if, you know, say your whole organisation has not yet got behind it, it can be very simple to do it if you wish. And that way you can provide value to, you know, people in your organisation from a very modest kind of technology investment. At the same time, those of you who will be going to your purchasing departments after today to ask them to buy you an iPod, I take no responsibility for whether you succeed with that. You can, though, point to this lecture as a, you know, proper reason why you need an iPod. So another area that's having quite some impact is open source software. And this is not just a thing about e-learning or training. It's a wider movement that is impacting the whole of the technology field. And in general, open source software, for those of you not familiar with it, is software where anyone can view, they can use, they can modify and redistribute the source code, that is the instructions that make the software do what it does. And so people can add to software, they can co-develop it, and so on. Perhaps one of the things that's most well known for is that open source software is generally no-cost software. You can download it, you can use it, there's no cost that comes with it. You might want to pay for support for open source software as an optional thing, but there's no license fee itself within the software. One of the things that's great about open source software, and I've seen its impact in e-learning contexts, is it allows people to try out new bits of software very quickly and easily. You know, they can get access to it, they can set it up, maybe on their desktop, maybe there's a website they can go to for demos, and it makes it easy to get to know something and what it might be able to do without having to go through a very long, you know, possibly complex procurement process with central IT and all the, you know, the issues that might involve. So that's been one of the ways it's been having quite some impact, as a kind of a way of doing quick and easy testing of ideas, of innovation, of new systems, to allow people to get a handle on those. Over and above that, there are some great open source e-learning systems that have been coming out. One of them, Moodle, is an open source learning management system. Actually comes from Australia originally. It's led by a guy in Perth called Martin Dougiamas, and has become one of the world's leading learning management systems, you know, in general, you know, whether open source or not. And I know a number of corporations now are using it just because it's got such great features, not just because there's no license cost. In my own work, the LAM software that we provide, which is a learning design system, a slightly different kind of system, we also make freely available as open source software as a way of fostering people to be able to try it out, use it, and also for those who are programmers to co-develop it with us. So finally, let me just speak to the last one for today, and that is learning design. This is sort of a new field where it's all about sequences of collaborative activities. It's about putting together a kind of workflow of tasks that you want your trainees to work through, and very often in group-based and formal kinds of learning contexts. One of the really exciting things about learning design is, over and above its benefits for doing structured group learning, when you as a trainer create a learning design, create a sequence of tasks, it becomes something that you can store and then reuse again, or share with colleagues, and other colleagues can use the learning design that you've built, or they can modify it and adapt it and perhaps, you know, improve it and share it back with you. One of the great things about learning design is it's a great way of moving beyond what sometimes called a sort of single learner view of courseware. You know, courseware where it's really ultimately just an individual sitting at a screen stepping through, you know, the courseware on its own, and moving to a more structured way of having groups step through activities. Could be content, could be discussion. And we've seen some great uses of learning design where it's a kind of adjunct to face-to-face training, or it's, you know, used for blended learning. You have a sequence of online tasks beforehand, maybe review some documents, maybe some discussion and so on. You then have a face-to-face session where you do some things together, and then afterwards you have some subsequent online learning tasks. I'll just show you very briefly, LAMS. I was going to do a demo of this today, but for the sake of time, I won't get into it. There is, down in the exhibition hall, a LAMS stand where you can go and find out more about this if you're interested. But as I said, it's open source software. It allows trainers to create these activities. It can be great for synchronous learning if you have a group of trainees in a computer lab and you want to use some structured computer-based group learning. It can do that. It's also great for asynchronous learning, those where people are coming at different times of the day and maybe different locations over a week or two-week period. And as I said, because you can share the activity designs that you build in LAMS, one of the things that's been happening is there's a community website where people have started to share these with each other. And so there's about 190 great learning designs already available today that you can go and look at, you can use, you can modify, and so on. And if any of you think this is interesting to try out, this website, demo.lambscommunity.org, allows you to sign up for just a quick demo account, try it out and see how it looks. Just to give you a flavour for what it is, and this is the one thing I'll show for today, this is the authoring environment for lambs, where as a trainer you can create a sequence of activities that you want your trainees to work through. And the basic concept is that you have a suite of activity tools on the left. Many of them are familiar to you from learning management systems, things like chat and forum and quiz and content. Some of them are more sort of collaborative tools, like a group Q&A, where you give everyone a question, everyone answers it individually, and then the system collates all the answers and represents them so everyone can see what everyone else's ideas were. It's also a sort of collaborative voting, where everyone votes on, you know, certain topics. The system collates all the votes and then represents the votes so everyone can see how did the group vote in total. So these are the sort of tools, and what you do is you just drag and drop them into this main area in the centre. You can then just draw lines to create the flow of tasks, and then you would open each individual tool to set up the details. What is the question you want people to consider? You know, what document or website do you want people to look at? What topic do you want them to discuss in a discussion forum or a chat room and so on? And so what we're looking at here is this is an example of a lamb sequence used in a blended training context, where prior to a face-to-face session, which is this sort of dark blue one that I'll come to in a moment, what people have been asked to do is to answer a question about, you know, the topic that they're considering, and they get to see everyone else's answers. It's sort of like an icebreaker task to get some ideas out there. In this case, where there was about 20 learners, they've been broken up into small groups of about five, and then each have been given a chat area where they can go in a small group and debate some ideas about, you know, the original topic they've been asked to consider. After they've done that for a while, the trainer who's running this releases then, by releasing this stop point, some resources to look at, some background reading, maybe some, you know, audio recordings or other materials that people need to go through before they come to the face-to-face training session. And so the first four tasks are all sort of pre-face-to-face activities. When they come to the face-to-face session, there's then, a 2-hour workshop, and that involves some discussion, some lecturing, some review of materials, and so on. And in this sequence, the fact that it's got that dark colour, what that's saying is that this activity will be run offline, that it won't actually use a discussion forum to run it, it'll be done face-to-face by the trainer. But by doing that, it allows you to say that if ever you had to run this sequence again in another context, and you weren't able to get everyone together face-to-face, and so you were going to do it as an online discussion instead of a face-to-face discussion, you can actually turn on that forum to run that on your behalf. And so in that case, what you have is a fully online set of activities based off the same sequence, where you're choosing whether or not you're going to do face-to-face or online learning. Finally, in this particular context, after the face-to-face session, there's another stop point that the trainer can release, and so afterwards people can do additional work, fill in a survey about the training, reflect in their notebook about what they've learned, maybe complete a quiz to test their knowledge, and so on. And so the concept of this learning design approach is that as a trainer you can just simply drag and drop a set of activity tools of different kinds, build the flow of tasks, and then configure each tool for the particular topic that you're doing training on. It's a very exciting new area. There's lots of really interesting work going on there. And so if that looks like it's something that may be interesting in your context, I'd recommend that you have a look at the demonstration account or some of the other materials about lambs on the internet. So the last thing I'd like to reflect on before perhaps opening up for some questions is this issue of incremental versus disruptive innovation. One of the things that we know from some of the recent analysis of innovation in organisations, not just in e-learning but generally, is that some technologies tend to have a small, modest impact on the way that people do their business or do their work, and that incremental advance by making things a bit more efficient or improving quality a bit and so on, it does it in a way that doesn't change their main work practices. You know, their lives are kind of the way they were before, they're just a bit easier or a bit better or a bit faster and so on. And that is an incremental innovation, can be of great value to an organisation. But there's other kinds of innovations where they may have very significant benefits. They may change things in a really great way and be much more efficient or whatever it is. However, in doing that, they disrupt people's lives. They force them to work in a different way or think in a different way to change their approach to the way they do their work. And so these more disruptive innovations, while potentially very valuable, can have all sorts of other effects in organisations. And so when you consider some of the technologies I've talked about today or other ones that you may come across, it's always worth reflecting on, will the introduction of this technology to my organisation represent an incremental innovation? Will it help make things just a little bit better and a little faster? Or will it be more disruptive? Will it actually change the way that some important things work? And as a result of that, may there be other issues I need to think about in terms of organisational culture and so on that will arise from a disruptive innovation? And I should say, and this is something that's come up very much in our work, is sometimes there's an assumption that a given technology is either incremental or disruptive. And I don't think that's often the case. They can be either incremental or disruptive depending on how you use them. The way they get used in the organisation often affects whether they have a disruptive impact or not. And so to end off with, I want to give an example from three of the things I talked about today of how they can be either incremental or disruptive depending on the context. So I think the use of blogs, you know, simple web diaries to act as a kind of internal communication mechanism, as something that's not publicly on the internet, it's just within your corporate intranet or within the context in which you work, as a way of having discussion about evolving ideas, of sharing, you know, the thinking about maybe a new product development or a new training program. This can often be a great incremental step. It helps people understand a bit more of what's going on. People can read your reflections and so on without a major impact on your work. On the other hand, a public blog where all people within your organisation, be it the CEO or anyone else, is talking publicly where anyone can read, including your organisation's competitors and your clients and your suppliers, this can in some cases have a much more disruptive impact. You know, if, for example, there are public comments which criticise the organisation, you know, if a staff member says they think the CEO made a terrible decision and they shouldn't have done this and so on, or maybe they reveal some kind of internal information that was meant to be maybe some, you know, new secret product that's being developed that suddenly becomes known to competitors. This can obviously have a much more disruptive effect on the training department and on the people who use blogs in that way. And so there needs to be some care about its introduction. That's why many organisations that do have public blogs now have policies about what is appropriate and inappropriate for staff to say in those contexts. So that's one example. The second one is the use of podcasts, and I think these can be fantastic for sort of incremental advancement where you're providing more flexibility to your trainees or your learners in the time at which they learn, the place where they learn, and the pace of it, their ability to stop and start, to replay, and so on. And so I think that's got many benefits. However, there can also be some disruptive impacts of that, and we are seeing this at Macquarie University. One of the challenges Macquarie now faces is having done this great supportive thing that I should say our students love. You know, today's 18 and 19-year-olds, let alone those who are, you know, older and doing work and so on, find it really helpful and flexible that they can now listen to their lectures at any time because they're audio recorded. However, for some students, they've stopped coming to lectures. And so we're starting to see students who don't come to lectures very much or at all because they know that the podcast will be there. And then what happens is that all the students in week 12 or week 13, the end of the semester, suddenly try to sort of consume an entire course worth of podcasts, you know, hours and hours of this, often into the early hours of the morning, and with two problems. One is, firstly, they bring the university network to its knees because we have hundreds of students trying to download gigabytes worth of podcasts all at once, which is not a great experience. But also, it's not a particularly good learning experience for them. You know, they lose that opportunity to reflect on ideas over time that they would otherwise have had. They lose the interaction with their peers that might have been part of discussion within lectures and so on. And so there's this interesting disruptive element here that's come out of the use of podcasts that I would at least encourage you to reflect on if you consider something similar in your organisation. This one's been fascinating at Macquarie because we're getting two very strong messages from our students. One is that, yes, they know that at least some of them, it's not all of them I should say, but some modest percentage of them are behaving in the way I said. And they recognise that's not good for their learning. You know, if they're being candid, they'll tell you, no, it's not great that I'm waiting till the very end of the course and then I download all of them. On the other hand, if you then said to them, well, should we stop providing them? Would it be better that we forced you to lectures? The answers are pretty universal. Absolutely not. We want the podcast. It's our right to choose how we learn and our time and our place. You know, you should definitely not turn off this great thing that you've given us. So it's a fascinating sort of challenge that we have to think through in this case. For the purpose of today, I just flagged that it's worth thinking about, you know, these perhaps unintended disruptive impacts of new technologies over and above what might appear to be the more simple benefits incrementally. And finally, in the case of learning design, the area in which I do a lot of my work. We've seen some great benefits from having more structured group-based learning and being able to actually step people through a series of tasks that you want them to do as a group and to learn from each other in a kind of more structured workflow. And that can be a great way of both sharing designs among trainers and of giving our trainees a sort of a more scaffolded, a more structured approach to their learning. But one of the disruptive impacts of this, and this is a positive disruptive impact, but nonetheless it's been in some cases unexpected, is that for those educators who for the first time see the training processes that they use visualised for them, if I just go back, if this allows you to visualise the way you do training, we've found regularly people, once they've used this software for a while, start to say, you know, this is making me think about why I do training the way I do. And why do I use this order of tasks? You know, maybe my discussion task, I should have it earlier so that people can get into their ideas sooner. Or maybe I should hold it till later and introduce more content at the beginning. And so we're seeing this a positive but disruptive impact on the way that our trainers think about their own pedagogy. You know, their actual concepts of teaching and learning and the best ways of doing it is being affected by the visualization of the teaching and learning process. And while I think that's very exciting, and many people who've used LAMS find that a real benefit, it's not what people thought. Those people who thought, oh, I'll just use this technology, do a bit of group-based learning, that'll be great, didn't anticipate that the byproduct of using the technology might be a fundamental reconceptualization of the way they think about training and pedagogy. So let me conclude then. I think there's, you know, lots of really exciting innovations out there, and one of the things for those of you in big organisations will probably be well aware, even if you're not, as a say, you know, central training and support, bringing these technologies in, they're probably out there already. You know, staff in different units or business groups may already be playing with these, regardless of whether or not you've actually introduced them or supported them. I think a good way to think about many of these technologies is through the lens of informal versus formal learning and trying to think which technologies support which kinds of learning and then what are the major needs in your organisations you need support. You know, if there's a lack of informal knowledge transfer, then things like wikis as a way of getting knowledge bases up and running can be a great tool. If, on the other hand, your formal learning is not being shared among trainers very well, then the structured and visual process of a learning design might be a great way of getting more agreement and sharing of standard training processes. And I would say also that this question of incremental versus disruptive innovation from these technologies is always important to have in mind. If you bring a new technology into your organisation that has a disruptive impact that you hadn't thought about beforehand, that may lead to all sorts of other implications for you in managing that disruption and cultural change. And so wherever possible, read case studies about new technologies in other organisations and try and reflect on the way that you might use those new technologies. If a disruptive innovation is going to be good for your organisation, then there's nothing wrong with that. However, you need to think about planning for that, briefing your senior executives, making sure colleagues understand how this might have an impact on their lives. And finally, and this is sort of a segue to our next speaker, a great resource on emerging technologies and innovations are the Brandon Hall Emerging set of reports, and so that's another resource that I'd encourage you to consider if you're keen to see more innovations and other technologies I haven't had time to talk about today. But otherwise, my thanks, and I'll take any questions. Yep. In the case of what we're doing at Macquarie, at the moment it's just an audio recording. Almost all lecturers will also put up their slides to accompany that, and so students can sort of click through the slides while listening to the audio lecture. But there will be contexts where that's not ideal. You know, if there are things about the way a presenter, you know, their sort of body language that's important to the learning experience, or perhaps where you've got, you know, demonstrations of things or where you're writing on the board, then those things can be lost. And so that can be a downside as well. Some of the podcasting software that's coming out now is adding video recording as an option to sort of compensate for that, and it'll do it to some extent. But I also think, I mean, you know, the buzz and physical experience of being in a lecture can be a great thing, certainly if it's a good lecture. And so that is lost in this context. And one needs to balance the benefits of flexibility in time and place with some of the things that are being lost. And so, you know, I certainly don't want to suggest that it's an unqualified good. I'm just saying, you know, there's this mixture of things involved in evaluating it as an interesting innovation. Any other questions? All right. Well, we're up to time, so thank you very much for your attention. I'll be around if anyone has some questions for me. And as I said, down in the exhibition hall, there's some more demonstrations of lamps for those of you who are interested in it. Thank you.